Thank you. Good morning. Charleston calls and you have to come, right? So my job, as I understand it, at 8:15 in the morning is to wake you up and get you energized for the conference. And there's nothing that does that better than a big head on a screen. So with that. Now, when I give presentations, I normally sort of build to the big conclusion. But I've learned that as I'm getting older, I'm getting more impatient. So I'm just going to give you the conclusion now. I believe that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us. I believe that all that discussion about how it used to be wonderful and, oh, we're going to have trouble and, oh, we're going to be obsolete, no, wrong, completely wrong. I believe that the golden age of librarianship is within our grasp, and I think it's coming soon, and I think that it's going to last a long time. I think we're the right profession, uniquely positioned to lead in the knowledge age. I mean, it's amazing to me when you look at all the different factors going around that there aren't, that there's no group better positioned to take advantage and get resources and improve society and have a beneficial impact than librarians. That we have the tools, we have the value system, we have the passion to really bring about and make the society better. However, this is one of those horrible but, we won't get there following current trends and with our current focus on recorded knowledge. Now, this may be a really dangerous thing to say at an acquisitions conference. But once again, in terms of the conclusion earlier, I asked you, are you buying all of those books and all of those journals because they look pretty on the shelves, or are you doing them because hopefully they're having an impact and we're doing them for purpose, right? So this is not a radical, it's like serials librarians. It's as if the truth is out there and we're getting it month by month and we're waiting for the conclusion. It's not. Yeah, we're getting this because we're in the midst of a conversation and that's part of what we're doing. So there's the conclusion. There's the ta-da, but let's get to it. So if we're in sort of following the current trends isn't going to get us there. What is? Well, we need a new concept of librarianship. We need to rethink our profession. We need to spend some time and reflection and think about what it is to be a librarian today, unencumbered by artifact centrality, understanding the materials that we bring to bear, understanding the buildings that we may inhabit, understanding the websites we may build are merely a means to an end. That we need to focus instead on knowledge and conversation, and that we must be dedicated to social action, leadership, and innovation. So we're going to hit this in a little bit, but let me just pick on a few of these. First of all, the notion of leadership. We are a service profession, but to be a service profession doesn't mean to be a servant profession. It means that we have a point of view and we bring our communities forward and we have a dedication to pointing the right direction and helping people get there. And that means that we lead. We're also very much in the innovation game. I think people look at innovation, and too often we think of these sort of, you know, grand geniuses sitting in the corner thinking and then boom, out pops an iMac or something, right? That somehow innovation is something big and rare and individual genius. But it's not true. Innovation is a mindset. Innovation happens every day. Innovation happens when you're looking at something, a simple process of procedure and saying, we can do this better. And you never know what the consequences of that innovation may be. They may be tremendous. They may be huge. And I think that one of the things that as librarians, we seek for our communities and our members a radical improvement in their conditions. And if we seek radical improvement in the conditions of our members, how can we be a conservative, risk-averse, slow-to-move profession? We can't. We're not. We will not be. So what I want to start with then is I want to present you a little framework to think about. If we're here, where are we going? And this is actually a framework that I developed and work with our doctoral students, because doctoral students, when they're new doctoral students, they're fabulous to get a hold of. You can really torture young minds easily with new doctoral students. Because and the best part is the second year after they finish all their methods classes, because they're like, you know, the new deer with the little antlers where they keep rubbing against things to try and get the skin off of. Because they just keep walking around and saying, well, what's the validity of that? What's the reliability? Is that a p-value? You're like, shut up. You know? But But the problem with doctoral students when they start is that we sort of smack the testosterone out of them. When they come into the program, they're all about, I'm going to discover, you know, radium. And by the time they're done, they're writing dissertations on, like, you know, why on Thursday at 2 p.m. I can validly say that this undergraduate was hungry. You know, we sort of limit their work. And what I try to say is, no, you need to do something more than just sort of explain things. Think about a research agenda. Think about an agenda. You know, it would be a lot of research that goes on in lots of fields, and I'll blame library science as well, looks a lot like doing customer exit surveys on the deck of the Titanic. Lovely buffet. Great music. Little too much iceberg. Right? You know, we need to have impact with what we do. So what we do is we start with the situation. We look at today, and we say, what is this situation? What are the things we're going to look at? So we can say librarianship. And then we want to look at, given all the trends, given how everything's going, what would our predicted future be? And this is where doctoral students get stuck, and frankly, this is where a lot of professions get stuck, and frankly, this is where our conversation on the future of libraries is stuck, which is, oh, well, given all this data, boom, this is what happens. But I ask you a question. If you go and do all this data, if you go and look at all the current trends, if you go read all the stuff and you find out that the future of librarianship is obsolescence and closing, are you okay with that? Because that's what this model gets you to if you say, oh, well, this is the conclusion. Now, I'm not saying that's the conclusion this model gets you to. It just says that's what you're allowed to do with your conclusions, which is, okay, we don't like that. We like to think that our actions make a difference, and so therefore we need to determine an ideal future. This is what we want to happen, and between a predicted future and an ideal future, there will always be a gap. Now, that gap could be really, really tiny, or that gap can be monumental and huge. But it's only with these three points that we can begin drawing a line and say, how do we get from today to our ideal future, and break that down into a series of steps and tasks to get us there. Right? This is how you determine a research agenda. This is how you determine your next job. This is determines sort of what you want to do. Right? So let's take a little bit of a look at today. And today is actually a good day to be a public librarian. Because if you haven't done it yet, just go to Google. This is a simple Google search on increase in public library usage, and you will find newspaper article after newspaper article about how usage is exploding, which is really great when newspapers are telling us how well we are doing. But the idea here is, right, you know, I could show you the video with Brian Williams saying how great we are, and Katie Couric and CNN, and this is a good day to be a librarian because it turns out that there's this little problem with the economy, and people are coming to us. And as Rahm Emanuel says, you know, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste, and we have it. We've been using it great. I do, however, ask you the question, though. I'm not sure this is the best strategy to really push forward with library usage, because what it means is that we have to sort of, you know, cause the next Great Depression to get our stats up. And I'm not sure we want to be there, but, you know. It also means, by the way, I love this, you got to be careful, because I know a lot of directors and people go up and say, look, people love us, that realize, follow that logic for a moment, which is, as the economy destroys itself, people can't afford Amazon and whatever, so they come to us. So we are the Walmart of the information world. You will not be cataloging anymore, you'll be greeters. I'm not sure that's really where we want to position ourselves. I think we want to think about, what can we do so that when the economy gets better and all our money goes up, of course, yay, how do we keep them? So the other side of this, though, is that actually if you just take that, it's wrong. If you look at those numbers, they're actually wrong. We need to take a broader viewpoint. Because one of the interesting things, I'm going to show you some statistics. This is from all of the Iowa Public Library. So the state library collects all the data. And what I want you to see is this is checkouts. Whee! But I want you to notice something, which is I want you to look at the bottom axis. That started in 1998. When I, you know, in 2005, I was going around and speaking in Massachusetts and speaking in other states, and the story was the same, which is usage is exploding. The economy didn't bring people to the library. It's highlighted why they can get the libraries. Wow, free stuff. Who thought? Meanwhile, people have been coming more and more, right? We can look at visits. Here's visits going up. Those are impressive numbers, and they're over a decade, right? We need to see, actually, what caused that. Well, let's see. What happened in the mid-90s that might have driven people to the library? Let me think for a moment. Oh, yeah, the web, right? This notion that the internet explosion, getting online databases, getting more resources, coming public access computing, may be a better explanation than people losing their jobs. And we need to think about that, because as we continue to do our services, if we don't understand why they're coming at a deeper level, then we may be doing the wrong thing in order to support them. By the way, just because we're in South Carolina is not unique. That is circulation and visits as well. So, now, people look at this data and they say, Dave, shut up. You know, we don't need to rethink librarianship. We're doing great. Yay! People are coming in. Why do you want to bother us? I mean, the other thing is we're kind of busy, right? You know, this whole Dublin Core thing, we'll get that figured out eventually, I promise. And by the time we get figured out, it'll be time for the semantic web, which will screw everything up. And then, of course, all our reference colleagues are busy trying to figure out if they can IM the world in their reference questions. And in our spare time, there are a few social networks that we have to keep up with. Right? So shut up about new librarianship. We're doing fine. Yay. However, Derek Law, I think, put it really well, which is he said, you know, librarians have become so busy and adept at keeping the library efficient and well-managed that we have lacked the space to step back and observe it from a higher level. And why do we need to do it? If we're doing so fine and our data's going up and we're busy and we're living, why care? Well, let me show you two examples of why care, which is if you don't have a deeper sense of why you're doing what you're doing, not what you're doing, not how you're doing it, but why you're doing it, you run into a functional blind spot. You look at the wrong stuff. So I'm going to give you an example. This is two screenshots. Read them as your leisure. Of encyclopedias. Now, this is in August of 2004. The top one is Wikipedia. The bottom is a little thing called Microsoft Encarta. Now, in 2004, if I had asked you which one wins, would you really have picked up, like, you know, the strangers where anyone can throw crap into a wiki site, which I'd never heard of, or maybe the one that has had a massive hit in the K-12 market, has all the Microsoft money behind it in marketing, right? If you define these things as functionally equivalent, they are encyclopedias, in 2004 the common logic was it needs to be strongly edited, we need experts with it, we need the credibility of the organization, we need a large institution behind it, and what happened? Well, over the next couple of years, Wikipedia went up and Microsoft Encarta literally took its website off last month. It's done. Now, in retrospect, we look at it and go, oh, no, what we really meant was social networking and the wisdom of crowds, and we sort of retrospectively look at it and try and figure it out. But my point with this one isn't just, look, interesting stuff going on. It's, would you have predicted at the time, would you have thought that the idea of social involvement in encyclopedia was a critical factor? Probably not. And the other one is, just because you're doing well and succeeding at one task does not mean you guarantee success in the future. In fact, quite the opposite. Microsoft was amazingly successful with Encarta. I mean, we're talking World Book and Britannica going, oh my God, Microsoft, right? These people caused fear and changed the industry. And when they saw different stuff happening, what did? They kept doing the same thing. And now, oh, well, we'll let a blog go on the corner of it and nibble around the side. Worldview matters. Functional views matter less. Success in current tasks does not guarantee future. I'll give you one more example. This is MySpace at the top versus Yahoo GeoCities at the bottom. Both of them functionally claim to give you a place on the web to share your stuff, give you your homepage. The difference was MySpace would let you make it look really ugly, and GeoCities would make it look really pretty, but the other one is MySpace was all guaranteed about not necessarily you putting your stuff up, but you and your friends putting up stuff. GeoCities was all about broadcast. And what happened? Well, ta-da. Right? We have the situation now. Yahoo, GeoCities, in October, went offline, closed the site. So functional views, just being successful at what you're doing and not understanding why you're doing it, doesn't help us, and in fact can hurt us. Which is, if we were suddenly really successful before the Great Recession hit, and people started coming in, and we assumed it was because of the Great Recession, and so we started doing all these things like, forget about building this collection, and forget about doing this service, it's all about job seeking, job finding, and free Danielle Steele all day. When the economy recovers, we may well have gutted the things that really brought them in for the past decade. So we need to take that wider viewpoint. So let's go back into our agenda here, and let's take a look at predicted future. Right? Now, this is the gloom and doom portion of the presentation, just so you know. But what I want you to do is I want to give you certain trends that I think if these trends carry out and we don't address them, we have a bleak future. So first of all, the shift in ownership to a rental model. The idea that somehow libraries build collections by owning things and circulating has become a quaint idea, and no one knows that better than the people in this room. Right? You guys started by becoming bibliographers and understanding your topic, and now you're negotiators and economists. Right? That what we've done is we've shifted around how we have stuff. So that at any point when the license fee peaks or when the vendor goes out of business or what have you, suddenly we've lost access to lots of stuff, and increasingly it's the stuff that people are looking for. Now, I'm not going to spend much time on, you know this better than I do, databases, the digital rights management, the idea of digital content being licensed now and not purchased, etc. An explosion in artifact production. Which is one of the things that if you guys are busy acquiring everything in X, you now know that X is exponentially larger and there's no way you can get it all. And it's going to get worse. And not only books and not only journals and serials, but web pages and everything else. And add to that the idea of a disaggregation of content where now you can go directly to the publishers and now the content aggregators are having really awkward conversations with the content producers and every professional society in the universe has decided that yes, eventually everything will be open access, but until then they're going to drain you dry. Little things. Thank you, sponsors of the conference. Just ignore that. Except those people. I was here a couple years ago. We talked about the explosion of data, the idea that we're talking about terabyte data sets. They're now talking about the National Security Administration building a data center with a zettabyte of information. You thought a couple of years ago I was crazy with that, but you know, it's frightening. And finally, the disintegration of traditional publishing models. Who do you buy anything from? This is a great little quote. One of my favorite radio programs, I'll read it. One of the favorite radio programs I have is called On the Media on NPR, and they sort of talk about the media, and they did this beautiful special on the music industry. And they got this quote where they talk about, if you run a, you know, if you're a music publisher, your life is bad. If you still exist on a label, you know, your life is really horrible. If you happen to sell music, your life is just over. And then he gets this quote. But Tim Quirk of the music subscription service Rhapsody says, the rest of us, fans and musicians, are better off than we were 10 years ago. Far better off. It's almost a paradise. As a listener, it means you've got access to almost anything you want to hear, almost anywhere you are, almost whatever you want. If you're an artist, labels are now an option, not a necessity. You can go direct to fans if you want to. Even if you opt to go with the label, you can get, depending on the label, you can get better terms than you can, and then you can be able to get, because nobody's got a lock on distribution anymore. Now, here's the question I want to ask you. If your primary mission as a librarian is to acquire stuff, this is very scary because you're on the equation of, I got to get more stuff and now I can't afford it and I can't buy it and my publishers who I used to get, the jobbers are breaking apart. If you're on the side of the users, the musicians and the fans, you live almost in paradise. Which side of that equation would you like to be on? All right. So what we really want to do is we want to look at an ideal future. So if that trends continue and we keep our focus on the stuff and the stuff is blowing up around us, we have problems, where do we want to get to? What is this ideal future that we want to head to? All right? And I'm going to start with a simple question. The question is, what is the future of libraries? And why I want to ask that question is because it's a horrific and horrible question. It's just a bad question. If we go back to the idea of doctoral students, one of the first things we tell them is the most important thing skill you can develop as a scholar is to ask good questions. Right? And this is a bad question. Why? Well, first of all, it assumes a lot of stuff. It assumes that it's all about libraries as institutions and not librarians as individuals. It assumes that the future is static and we are simply discovering it, and it misses a lot of other points. So let me rephrase it for a moment. What should be, that little twist from is to should be, is a massive shift that we need to think about. If you live in a world of positivism and fate, you are discovering a future that is going to happen to you, and you need to stop that thinking. What we exist in is a future of creation, where we have an opportunity to shape that future. We have an obligation to shape that future. All of those factors I brought up are up to us to determine how we react to them, how we replace them, how we think about them. And that means that we have a personal responsibility for invention and innovation and leadership. And the future of libraries is fine, but I'm much more interested in the future of librarians. And I think that's a semantic difference that we need to take on very strongly. A library is a building, and all a building can do is eventually rot and fall down. Librarians are people, and we create the future, and we create what happens in it. If all the librarians disappear, it is simply an empty warehouse. And that's not what we're about. So it's about you. And democracy is we keep forgetting why we're doing it. How many people feel like you are chasing the next O'Reilly book? Right? That you are going to be whatever for dummies. Oh, there's a new technology. I'll go get the book. Right? Why are you doing that? We spend so much time running after procedures and policies and new technologies that we forget that we're in a larger game here. And that larger game is not about recorded knowledge. Now, this is where we're going to come back for a moment. There is no such thing as recorded knowledge. It is like talking about a talkative rock. The words do not fit together. You're sitting there going, oh, yes, there is. I read the ALA core competencies. It's right there. They're wrong. I'm willing to say that out loud. And I'm going to prove it with a rock. There's a rock. Now, you look at this rock. Some of you may know it. Ayers Rock in Australia. You look at this rock. I look at this rock, and I see big red, right? A geologist looks at this rock and they can see formative processes and chemical compositions and geological systems that created it. An anthropologist can look at this rock and see cultural significance, can see the whole notion of myth and such. But the point of this is that the geologist did not discover the knowledge in the rock. They brought the knowledge to the rock. I look at this and I think about the trip I took with my wife to Australia, but it's not in the rock. It's in me. Knowledge is not a thing. Knowledge is dynamic, it's living, it's human, it's how we understand stuff. These are artifacts. So when we talk about creating knowledge, when we talk about understanding knowledge, we must understand that it is not a thing. We cannot put knowledge on a stack. Right? I have a 6-year-old who's in the process of first grade of improving his reading. This is how it will not happen. I will not walk into the library, abandon him in the fiction section, come back 2 weeks later and see how it's going. The books will not leap out onto his head and go, read me, right? It's an active process. In fact, when we look at knowledge, we have to understand it is a process. Now, what does that process look like? Well, a fellow by Gordon Pask said, the way you create knowledge is through conversation. And that means that you have conversants going back and forth. So when I'm reading, I'm having a conversation, but it's not with the book. The words are not saying, well, Jay, what do you think about this, right? It's like talking about social catalogs, right, which is like staple gunning a satellite dish to a donkey, right? The books don't sit around at night going, did you see what the hell that patron was doing? I tell you, books aren't social. We are. The people who read them are. So we're not having a conversation with the book. We're certainly not having a conversation with the author. We're having a conversation with ourselves. We're having, do I understand this? Do I agree with this? Am I going to remember this? That's a good point. Who are you talking to? Yourself. So we have the conversants in it. When you're negotiating a new contract, you're having a conversation between your institution and another institution. What are these conversants doing? They're exchanging language. We'll get into this in a second. And what they're doing is exchanging language as they're seeking agreements. And agreements are understandings. We could call them facts, but they're not quite. Things like, it's a sunny day, it's a pretty day, it's a warm day are all agreements. I'm happy to be here, I'm not happy to be here, is an agreement. 2 + 2 = 4 is an agreement. And we remember these things over time in a memory, but what's important about our memory is that our memory is dynamic as well, and relational. Things like, you know, the height of Mount Everest is an agreement. The height that your airplane can fly is an agreement. It's only in the relation of these two that things become really interesting. Right? So this is what knowledge is. And so when we look at our mission and we say, what's our mission, given the idea that it's not necessarily artifacts, given the idea that it's about librarians and not libraries, given that it's about knowledge, what does our mission become? The mission of librarians is to improve society. Feel free to end it there. Through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. Right? Now notice a couple things about this. It's a mission of the librarian. It's not some divorced aggregate where, well, I don't know, the mission. Can you tell me what the mission statement of your library says? I mean, come on, unless you were on the strategic planning committee and you wrote up the t-shirts, right? Too many people say, oh, that's the mission of the library. My mission is 5 o'clock beer, whatever. It's a personal mission. It's your mission, regardless of institution. To improve society means that we have to have a sense of how society can be better, that we have a viewpoint, that we take a lead. I'll just tell you this right off the bat. This idea that somehow librarians are unbiased is crap. It's not true. If you get 5,000 things to pick from, you pick less than 5,000, you had to have some criteria by which you chose. We are intellectually honest. We must understand that we do make choices, that those choices are influenced, and that we are open to other choices, but there are still choices to be made. If you have no bias or no values brought into an equation, what value do you add to a community? You're a rock. No, we have a perspective. We have a voice. Little things like we believe that the best decisions are made in the richest information environments, that's a perspective. That is not an unbiased statement. Now, this mission has other things to it, right? So what do I mean by mission? What do I mean by librarians? How do we prepare them? What do I mean by improve society, Dave? Facilitate? What's facilitate mean? What's knowledge creation and what's the nature of our communities, right? We can take these major, what we call threads, and we can begin to investigate them. So let me show you an example, because the new librarianship we're talking about is not simply a statement of what we do, added together and say, ta-da, we must understand things at a deeper level, at a why level. So, Dave, you said it's great. We're in the knowledge creation business. We've already talked about how knowledge is created through conversation. This comes from something called conversation theory, and conversation theory has its conversants, its language, its agreements, its memory, right? So you see we're just sort of following this down in pretty circles. And we can take that, and we can put it in this form, and we can say, well, what do you mean by language, Dave? Well, there are really two kinds of language coming out of theory. One is called an L0, or negotiation level. One's called L1, which is an understanding level. You go, oh, God, help me. Why do I care? Well, here's why you care. I'm going to tell you a joke, and I'm going to explain language. Sherlock Holmes is called in to investigate a murder. He goes in, he does his thing, he looks around. You know, or in modern times, we could say Adrian Monk does it. And he comes out and he declares that the murderer is a librarian. Dr. Watson says, that's incredible, Holmes. How do you come to that conclusion? Elementary, my dear Watson. Of course, there's the fact that the victim's books were alphabetically arranged by genre, that the style of the murder came directly out of a rare volume from Victor Hugo that exists in a branch library down the street. But perhaps the biggest giveaway is the fact that after the victim was killed, the murderer dragged them to the toilet and wrote on their body, now can you find the bathroom? Now can you find the bathroom? Now, my wife didn't get that joke. And the explanation is about language, right? Everyone will get the books are arranged alphabetically, right? You can tell that to any audience and they'll get that joke. Ah, ha, ha, that's funny. Librarians, bun, you know, the whole stereotype. Because humanity scholars will get the second part about the Victor Hugo novel and such, but only librarians will get the bathroom part of that joke, right? But the idea is that we all have a unique language, how we represent them. And in the acquisitions business, in the cataloging business, when you look at a lot of librarianship, it's about coming up with universal forms of language in the form of Dewey Decimals and Library of Congresses and Getty and controlled vocabularies and classification systems. But they're only one language. And why is it that when you look at usage statistics about people in the catalog and you find out how efficient they are, librarians score off the chart and users score like dead. They're the ones sitting that Sherlock Holmes is investigating because they don't understand our language, right? Now, it gets worse than that because the idea is, well, we'll let them tag and we'll make it easier for them and we'll take lots of synonyms and it'll all work out. Here's the worst part. There's not one L1. It's not a matter of that Dewey came up with the only way to organize the world. In fact, I hope to God the people don't believe that. But the idea that, you know, if I'm a physicist, I want to hear physics language. I want to talk in physics shorthand. If I'm a geologist, I want to talk in geology terms. Our systems don't represent that. We build systems where we say, you learn our language and search them. We need to think very differently about this. We need to look at this and look at how we evolve our systems to be more useful. We need to look at them, even I can't read that, and move from a systems viewpoint where we took what the experts did and represented the experts. Everyone remember the wonderful dialogue command line searching, right? You knew it. You could do amazing things with it, but only if you understood the language. We move from that to user-based systems. That is, we ask the users what they think, and we end up with operating systems, and we end up with Windows-based catalogs that basically create dialogue searches. And now we're moving to the notion of user systems. Facebook, MySpace, think about it. The way these systems work is they build the systems around themselves. They're very limited in their functionality, but they can combine things like I took, you know, my favorite 80s star and I put a wall next to it and I uploaded video, and they build the system around their own language, their own needs, their own useful. So we can see in social networks how that fits. Now, that's very different than saying we need to be on Facebook. Why? Facebook. So you put together the Facebook, you get your two fans, both of which are librarians who put up the Facebook site. And what do? You let people search the frickin' catalog on it. Right? Understanding why you're there matters. Right? So now we can take the same rope. Instead of taking language, let's look at memory. We know that memory can be expressed as something called an entailment mesh, which is its relationship together. We can prototype what software might look like, and that means instead of virtual reference systems looking like this, type and push, they need to start looking like this, relationships of documents. Think about your own mind map and the area that you may be doing acquisitions of. You have a sense of what are the topics, what are the threads, how they're related, how this journal is related to this journal, this academic. That's a scheme that you have in your mind, not a series of slots. And that can lead to how we search these systems, and that can finally lead back to our evolutions of systems. So what we can do is, this is the idea of new librarianship cannot just be as simple of Facebook, right? And it's not just as simple of what we did before, but now we're wearing stretchy lycra because it's the future. It's the idea of how these ideas flow together, these threads of ideas. And we can look at those other elements of that mission I talked about, the idea of what do I mean by means of facilitation? Well, we provide access to conversations, not access to stuff. The stuff may spark a conversation, it may promote a conversation, it may document a conversation, but it's access to stuff, access to conversations that are important. And by the way, that means us providing agency to our own members' conversations, hosting them having blogs. We don't blog, right? What does that mean? Well, I put up a blog, I told them about all the times I had to tell our users what bathroom to go to, and no one came to my blog. It sucks. Blogging's stupid. Click. No! Host blogs for your members that want to engage other people conversations, right? We can talk about the notion of knowledge, which is, it's great that the ongoing physics conversations online, but if you don't know how to get online, we need to teach you basic computer literacy skills. We need to teach you all this stuff. Joan Bechtel in the 80s talked about an academic librarianship that library instruction should not be about how to find stuff. It should be about scholarly communication. It should be about the conversation. We talk about the idea of an environment to happen. Why do we worry about things like intellectual freedom? Because we are providing a sense of safety for our members that they are willing to participate in the conversation. How many of you have been you've been part of a conference committee and the committee has literally existed for over 50 years? Oh, come on. You've never gone to ALA? You walk in and you have an idea, and what's the first thing that happens?
Well, what you've got to remember is in 1942, we get
right, and they're shutting you down. That's not a safe environment to create a conversation in, right? For some of you, this is not a safe environment because we're going to ask you to get up in front of a microphone, and that takes courage. It might be better to do it online. It may be better to do breakout groups, right? So we have multiple vehicles for that to happen in. And finally, we provide motivation. We understand why people are coming. I'm going to run through this relatively quickly. We need to understand to truly facilitate means that we need to co-own our services with our communities. Give them part of the shelving. I had a great idea. I heard a great idea. Eli Nyberger was telling me about one of his patrons in Ann Arbor who said, if I can go to your catalog and I can find all the books at all the branches, why can't I put my stuff in the catalog so people can find my books as well? If they're willing to share it, I'll bring the books in. Why not? Why is that crazy when that's actually how public libraries started. Let's put all our stuff together. Right? It's an interesting idea. how we can truly own it. How many people say, we started a teen service because we want to serve teens? Great. How many teens are on your board?
Well, on our board.
Right? The idea of, if they don't own it, why would they use it? So we can look at that thread. We can look at a thread such as, what do I mean about the importance of worldview, which is the idea of understanding why we do things, not simply how we do them, and creating a whole new social compact with our communities to say, this is what libraries are about. We can look at the pressure for participation, which is when our communities use services, if they're learning, if they're coming to us to learn, and they are part of a conversation, conversations are two-way, right? You have to be in a conversation. You cannot passively sit and learn, right? It's like talking to a wall. It's a monologue. That means that you must be able to shape the conversation. So when our librarians come up to a catalog, come up to a reference librarian, come up to a collection development strategy, and they hear, no, we're not interested in what you have to say, push, 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 they sit there and go, well, let me see what else I can find, right? This is why this notion of social networking and tagging and all this other stuff, by the way, tagging sucks. We'll get into that later. No, we don't have time. Ask me afterwards. But this notion that they want to shape services, they want to look at different things. So, for example, in physical environments, we were at the Free Library of Philadelphia, and we talked to musicians, and we said, what do you want the library to look like as a musician? And they said, well, this is what it looks like now. What we want is two grand pianos on a stage. As musicians, when I'm talking, when I'm in a conversation, humming can only go so far. I want to sit down and play music, and that's, we're going to jam, we're going to listen, we're going to learn. That's how we interact. When we went to business people and we said, what can the public library do for you? They said, nothing. We're in businesses. We have our own libraries. But they said, but when I was just starting out, if the public library wasn't there, I never would have started my business. But that's all about entrepreneurship, which means it shouldn't look like a business reading room. It should look like this. I need a place to come in, to organize my thoughts, to pitch it, to get access to accountants, to get access to information. So we can look at this in physical environments, in our digital environments, we can look in hybrid environments, we can look at the idea of the importance of action and activism, which is if we see something in the community, we should actively try and fix something that's wrong. Right? We can look at service is not invisibility, it's a core value, and how those core values lead to things like intellectual honesty, not unbiased. So I'm just sort of retracing our steps. We can look at what are the core skills, how those core skills turn into the importance of technical skills, how this turns into LIS education. For example, that we need a curriculum in the LIS education which centers on change management, not leadership. We need to teach the new people how to come in and scare the hell out of us by bribing us with pizza to change. Right? We'll color code these for fun, and if we take this and we really break out each little idea, we end up with something we're calling the Atlas of New Librarianship, and it hits on things like, what is the relation of library science to information science? Get over it. We need to stop having the L versus I discussion and start having the I versus K discussion, which is instead of libraries versus information, it's information versus knowledge. What are we in? We're in the knowledge business, not the warehousing business. How we assess this, how that turns into our institutional repositories, how we can become publishers of the community, and ultimately an obligation to lead. So what I want to leave you with is the mission of librarians, your mission, my mission, is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in the communities. We do that through service. We do that by asking our community what they need. And sometimes we do that by giving the community what they don't yet know they need. And we do that because we are of the community. By serving the community, we also serve ourselves. We do that through leadership. We do that by pointing in a direction, by understanding how to improve society and how to make it. We do that through social action. We do that by looking at regulation. We do that looking at law and saying, that shall not stand. And we do it through innovation. If ultimately our job is to improve people's worldview, to create knowledge is to change how we see the world, we must constantly know that we are changing that world. This profession is about change. Librarians are about fundamentally innovation, positive improvement, positive change. It is with faith that we look to the future, faith in ourselves, faith in our colleagues, and an abiding faith in our communities. Through the lens of faith, we see where our communities have chosen knowledge over ignorance, the greater good over savage greed, openness over narrow-mindedness. But we're not blinded by faith. We know that these choices do not come easily every time. We know that our communities sometimes need our hands to pull them from the darkness. We will stand before that darkness of ignorance. Stand before that void of intolerance. Stand before an area of censorship, and we will yell into that voice, enough! Stop no more. And then hand in hand as a colleague, we will dismiss the night and the din. That's what we seek to do. We don't buy stuff. We don't catalog stuff. We don't understand stuff. We improve the world. We build knowledge. As librarians, we are noble agents of this society. We are here to make the world a better place. That is an awesome responsibility that we take on. We are not in jobs. We're on a mission. We have a vocation and a calling to say, we will not stand for a world that dismisses truth. We will not stand for a world that ignores information, data. We are perfectly situated to look within our communities and say, we can make you better through partnership. I have faith that we can do that. Thank you very much.
I've heard quite a lot of keynotes here. This is the best I've ever heard. I think it's fantastic.
Thanks.
And now, questions of people. Come up to these microphones in the middle. Anything from Gold at the moment, David? Jack? Anything from
Gold? Just a second.
Okay. I'm going to ask a question. I'll ask a quick question. Your mission statement could, in my view, talking to the person next to me, he agreed, could apply to publishers as well. Do you have any change?
The answer is, it could apply to publishers, but when you look at what makes a librarian, out of their worldview, it is first our mission to improve knowledge. Now, we share that mission with many people. We share that with teachers. We share that with lots of people. We have our means of facilitation, our tools and techniques, access, such. But the other thing we have are core values. And those core values of intellectual honesty, intellectual freedom, the idea of service, the idea of openness, those combined make a unique profession and scope.
Great. That's, anybody from upstairs? Jack?
Well, I can actually, I got something myself. I agree with you.
Jack's got a question.
Oh, I'd say this has been one of the best keynotes I've ever heard, too. I totally agree with you.
Thanks.
What you're actually proposing, and it's quite a noble thing that you are proposing, is a major systemic change in our organizational culture. As librarians, especially in academic libraries, how do you instill this kind of a vision when we've been so reactive for so many years? We wait, we're passive, we chase fads endlessly, spending countless resources on the next thing that's running around the corner on a gigabyte. You know, but I'm saying, how do you do this?
Slowly, no. The answer is, there's a great fellow by the name of Lewin, Kurt Lewin, who put together something called the change model. It goes something like this. Step one is freeze. It's called unfreeze, change, refreeze. And it looks something like this. What we are right now is frozen in a state. And you have to be frozen in what you do, or else it leads to a lot of tension, right? If your world is totally changing and constantly around you, you can't be productive. So we're frozen in a state. What we need to do is unfreeze people by two things. First, we give them a vision of where we want to go. And one of the questions I have is that I haven't heard libraries spend a lot of time talking about these deeper reflective issues. You know, what is our mission? What is our ultimate goal? What is a knowledge-based society? So you present this sort of attractive, we want to go here. But we also need to create dissatisfaction of where we currently are. Now, we're really at the gloom and doom part of the presentation. We can be there. You then move through a period of change, and change is a turbulent time. And I think a lot of people would love to have change be this easy sort of thing, and it never is. Jeffrey Katzer, a former colleague of mine, had a great saying. He said, change is like heaven. Everyone wants to get there, but no one wants to go first. Right? So we need to understand that we're going to go through a turbulent period. We need to understand, manage that, and just understand that life's going to be chaotic, like it's not already. And then we need to refreeze at the other end. And that's where I think as librarians we have missed it. We've been really good at what is the future of library, and here are the current trends, and we've got to change. And Dave says it's got to be about conversations, and they say it's got to be about this, whatever. But we need to, once we get people moving, they need to get restabilized, refrozen, find that regularity in their life. And if we don't give them that, they will automatically go back to what they used to do. And so we need to think about, well, how do we assess in this current environment? What are the job performance aspects? How does this translate into a service plan? So it's really a strategic planning process at that end, but it starts with a larger, true discussion, conversation among professionals, and with our community to say, what value do we bring? What do we add to this? Now, so, you know, the Atlas is coming from the big, long book that will no doubt be published on some specifics, but the short answer is start by understanding what your true mission is, get out of the gadget business, get into the, instead of becoming riding the waves, be the wave machine, and understand that you're going to need to build tools. Build tools. Librarians are builders of tools. We are not just consumers and users of that, and that means soft tools. I mean, schemas are tools. Classification systems are tools. But we also need a lot of internal, strong technical knowledge to try and make these pictures. We need to draw pictures of what the catalog looks like. We need to draw pictures of what the check-in, check-out system looked like. So, you know, there's nothing dramatically new that I'm saying in how we change, just that we must change.
Question. Come up to the microphone there and give your name and affiliation and ask your question. You've done it before, I know.
I'm Anjana Bhatt. I work at Florida Gulf Coast University. And when I went to school at Syracuse University, you were there.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, you have to say sorry because I came to you for internship and you didn't take me.
Oh, hurry up.
I have to say this, that this is the most enjoyable talk that I've ever seen at any conference. My question is that I perfectly agree with your statement that we have an awesome responsibility of, you know, helping the society. Could you please give us any tips or ideas that we can use to communicate this notion to authorities whose first idea of adjusting the budget cut is to reduce the funding for the library? How do we educate them that this is what we are doing and see the perspective that we have?
All right, let me give you a real, first of all, if you come back, I'm sure I can find something. let me give you a real specific way of doing it, and we tried in a couple of different places, and it goes something like mapping the conversations. So what we need to do is we need to get together. You first identify what are the key stakeholders within our group, administration, faculty, students, politicians, the historical society, what have you. You then go within, sitting down with them and say, what are you talking about? This is the worst kind of assessment to do is when you sit down with your members. By the way, I like the word members and not users or customers or patrons, and say, what do you think of a library? Don't ever ask that. It's a stupid question. If they're already sitting in the room, that's because they like you, and if they came or they have an axe to grind, you're not going to hit the middle. So you say, what are you talking about? What are the major issues you're hitting? Well, I'm in a small liberal arts college. We're rethinking the core. Map it. So within each group, you say, what are the major conversations going on? You then find out if there are any regularities to it. For example, if we're going to change the core curriculum at our college, we know it's going to go from faculty meeting to Senate to whatever, so we know the regularities. And then what you do is you draw a line between what services you have and those conversations. And if you find lines that don't go anywhere, cut them. And if you find lines that go there, what you then say is, which are the most important conversations? This is where the whole unbiased thing becomes problematic because you have to rate importance. And importance in two ways. One, where can we have the maximum impact to improve society? And two, where is it tactically most useful for the library to be, which is if they're going to redo the curriculum, we better be part of that conversation. Once you have that map, you have the tools to go in and assess what impact you've had. This is outcomes-based assessment to a degree, but you're basing it on the conversations, not on, you know, circulation and not on gate count and all this. You're basing it on, here are the conversations, here's where we intercepted and promoted, and here was the end result. You need to map your community from the conversations they're having, not from the things they consume, not from their structures, but literally what they're talking about, because that's the knowledge being developed, and that's what you need to facilitate.
Thank you. Okay, now we shouldn't really have more questions. We'll have one. But just I have to ask if gold has got anybody. Jack? Anybody upstairs?
Not at this moment.
Okay. One more question.
Okay, Bob Holly, Professor of Library and Information Science at Wayne State University. I wrote, after last year's conference, I wrote a column for Against the Grain in which I said that I felt that the conference was not so much about knowledge and improving society, but how we could get academics to have wonderful careers. And so that the focus is, in a sense, turned to not telling people to work on what excites them, but to work on what will get them tenure and raises and promotions. And that is troublesome, and I'm worried about it. I like what you say, but I worry about getting away from this sense of this is what you have to do to write your dissertation. This is what you have to do to get tenure. This is what you have to do to be a full professor. It's not what you love.
Good. Okay.
Ultimately, our job is to work with the communities to help them achieve their goals within an ethical constraint that it improves society, right? That mission statement, to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation, is two parts. The first part is do what the user wants, do what the user wants, do what the user wants. The second is an ethical counterbalance that says, but only if it is for the betterment of the larger community and service. Which means sometimes things like when the K-12 student comes up and asks the school librarian to do their book report for them, we are allowed to say no. Right? So to a degree, that dichotomy exists in your conversation as well, which is, I want to get tenure, I want to do this, I want to improve my career, is what they're saying. And the improved society says, okay, as an academic library, we have to support that. But at the other end, we want to have lots of enriching mechanisms to talk about following the heart, talk about this. And we need to look at how we assess it. I mean, the other thing is, let's be honest, if you're an academic professor and you don't get tenure, you cannot have the impact that if you did get tenure. And so either we need to change tenure, which, by the way, I think we need to change tenure, not eliminate it, for God's sake. But I was at, and I will be real quick because I know we're taking time. I was at a conversation talking about scholarly communication. And the answer was, professors won't do anything unless it affects tenure. And the answer back to, my answer back to them was, what are librarians doing to change the tenure process? And they looked at me like I was just the dumbest thing ever. Because I'm just a little librarian. What am I going to do about tenure? Hello? You are the memory of your institution. Right? So here's the strategy. You know who's coming up for tenure next year. Knock on their door the first day of classes and say, hi, I'm Dave, I'll be your tenure librarian. And you do their citation analysis for them. And at the same time, you get a copy of every stinking paper they ever wrote to put in your repository. And then, if they do get tenure, you are the best person in the world. They're your favorite person. They'll bring you into classes. They'll ask you questions. You built a stronger relationship to have the larger conversation. And if they don't, they get fired and they leave and can't badmouth you. So... my short answer to this is, if that is a systemic problem, and I don't disagree that it's a systemic problem, librarians can have an impact in that statement, and they must understand that they can be proactive on all levels of conversations, and not simply passive and a victim to it.